From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Egypt in trouble, unemployment ticks up, immigration front and center, guns too, and Chuck Hagel in the hot seat. A new immigration reform push, first by 8 senators from both sides of the aisle. It's high time, they said. Here was New York Democrat Chuck Schumer.
Other bipartisan groups of senators have stood in the same spot before, trumpeting similar proposals. But we believe this will be the year Congress finally gets it done.
Senate hearings on gun violence began with a moving statement from brutal gun violence victim, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords.
The time is now. You must act. Be bold. Be courageous. Americans are counting on you.
And former Senator Chuck Hagel's confirmation hearings as Secretary of Defense got hot in a hurry. His former Republican colleague John McCain demanded to know if he still thought he'd been right in his opposition to the Iraq surge.
If you would like me to explain why...
I would like an answer, yes or no.
Well, I'm not going to give you a yes or no. I think it's far more complicated than that. As I've already said, my answer is I'll defer that judgment to history.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Did you see Chuck Hagel get raked over the coals? What do you think? And will we move on immigration, on guns? Is it time? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington today, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Indira Lakshmanan, senior correspondent covering foreign policy for Bloomberg News. Indira, it's been a long time. It's great to have you here.
It sure has. Great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Indira.
Nancy, first to you. Is the Chuck Hagel nomination still on the rails?
Well, it was certainly not a good day for him. Let's start there. Even the White House has acknowledged that they were disappointed in his performance. That's from our chief White House correspondent, Major Garrett. But at this point, no one is throwing in the towel, and Democrats still seem to be standing behind him. We haven't heard from a single Democrat who's saying they're not going to vote for him. And as long as Democrats do vote for him, then he only needs five Senate Republicans to come to his defense and vote for him as well. And so right now, it looks like he has a very good chance of getting that, even though everyone acknowledges, Democrats, Republicans, maybe even Chuck Hagel himself, if you asked him, that it wasn't his finest day.
Well, Republicans went hard at him yesterday. And of course, he was Republican, U.S. Senator from Nebraska. Here was James Inhofe, Republican, Senator, Oklahoma, ranking member, going after Chuck Hagel's foreign policy positions yesterday.
On many of the security challenges facing the U.S. interests around the world, Senator Hagel's record is deeply troubling and out of the mainstream. Too often, it seems, he's willing to subscribe to a worldwide view that is predicated on appeasing our adversaries while shunning our friends.
Jack Beatty, did you see an appeaser there yesterday in the person of Chuck Hagel?
Well, he was asked a question that went to that. Senator Manchin of West Virginia said, tell how you got to Vietnam. And the short of it was he was to be sent to Germany, where he had learned how to operate a special shoulder-fired missile. And just before he was to be sent, he said, no, there's a war on. I'm volunteering for Vietnam. And Hagel said, of course, they send in the psychiatrists, the rabbis, the priest. What's wrong with this guy? What was wrong with him was that he was willing to do the right thing for the United States then, as he saw it, as his honor dictated. And Senator Manchin said, would you stand up to enemies of the United States? And he said, as Senator, I believe I've shown that I will do that. Anyone who could doubt the courage of this man, his stalwartness, yes, he stumbled and fumbled and he got details wrong, but what to this viewer, what came through was his gravitas and the weight of the past, the ghosts of Vietnam in it, and his objection to the surge, as he clarified the back and forth with Senator McCain, was he had that way in his mind, the certainty that more Americans would die against the uncertain result. And when he made that calculation, he came out, no, it's not worth it. And who's to say that he was wrong? You know, only 27% of the public now think Iraq was worth the candle.
Of course, there's the surge within the Iraq war, a war he initially supported and then turned against. Iran and the U.S. relationship with Israel at the heart of this conversation yesterday, really dominating. Here was Hagel talking about, he said all options would be with him at Secretary of Defense on the table with Iran.
As I have made clear, I am fully committed to the president's goal of preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And as I've been on record on that issue, and as I've said in the past many times, all options must be on the table to achieve that goal. My policy has always been the same as the president's, one of prevention, not of containment.
Not of containment, but there was that odd moment later where he came back, a note passed him saying, no, he wasn't for containment. Well, he didn't say for containment, at least there. Indira, he's taken a lot of heat on his not supporting unilateral sanctions on Iran, but remind us of the distinction that Hagel makes here. I think he has said he's for multilateral sanctions that everybody joins in on, but not for unilateral. Do I have that right, Indira?
That's right, Tom. And it's an interesting distinction because it's only been really in the last more than a year that in Washington there's taken on this incredible momentum for unilateral U.S. sanctions. It's not to say that the U.S. hasn't over the years wanted its own sanctions. But remember, Chuck Hagel was in the Senate at a time when there was not this, you know, massive pressure. We saw in December of 2011, Senator Menendez at the Senate Foreign Relations, really grilling, raking over the coals, two top Obama administration officials saying that we have to take action, we need to impose our own sanctions, and there was a completely unanimous Senate vote in favor of those sanctions despite administration opposition. So Washington is a very different place vis-a-vis Iran sanctions today than it was when Chuck Hagel was in Congress. That's
one point. It's not just the direction of the crowd, though, is it? I've heard him make the case that unilateral sanctions, that only the U.S. is laying down simply aren't effective enough. It's when everybody joins the sanctions, I've heard him say, that they work.
Again, it's different. A few years ago, when he was opposing unilateral sanctions, there was a lot of reason to think that other members of the international community would not cooperate with U.S. sanctions. Mm-hmm. In the last year plus, the U.S. has put the screws on so tightly on major oil buyers, China, India, Turkey, has basically said, if you don't comply with these sanctions and significantly decrease your imports of Iranian oil, we are going to cut you out of the U.S. banking system. And nobody wants to be cut out of the U.S. banking system. So just yesterday, we had the last interview with outgoing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and she told a small group of reporters who've been traveling with her on the plane for the last 4 years when we asked her, are these sanctions working? And she said, yes, we believe for the first time that they are crippling sanctions. We have gotten, you've seen over the last year that Iran's oil exports have basically fallen in half, and that's because of this unprecedented compliance with unilateral U.S. sanctions. So it's a complicated issue, but his point is a good one, except that now the U.S. does have cooperation with those unilateral sanctions.
The U.S.-Israel relationship, a very big issue in these hearings yesterday. Chuck Hagel apologizing for statements he made in 2006 that the Jewish lobby, quoting him, intimidates, again, quoting former Senator Hagel, people in Washington.
I've already said I regret referencing the Jewish lobby. I should have said pro-Israel lobby. I think it's the only time on the record that I've ever said that. On the use of intimidation, I should have used influence, I think would have been more appropriate.
Nancy Cordes, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina jumped in hard and said, name one senator who's been under this influence or intimidation, and Hagel declined to do that. On the other hand, you had the image there of the everybody piling on him. It was name one. Well, everybody was really going after him on this relationship,
right,
Nancy?
Right. And, you know, the White House argues that the Republicans went after him on a number of issues that are essentially outdated or that the public doesn't care about very much. So, yes, maybe blows were raining down on him from all sides from Republicans. But what the White House is hoping is that this really isn't going to register with the American public. Because, for example, you know, when it comes to the surge, this is an issue that most people made up their mind about years ago and aren't really thinking about anymore. So whether Chuck Hagel thinks that it was a success or a failure, you know, it's not really of much concern to them, whether he said pro-Jewish lobby or meant to say Israel pro-Israel lobby, you know, is not really an issue of great importance to the American public. So, you know, while he could have risen up and mixed it up a little more, it almost seemed as if they had told them, look, the Republicans are going to try to get your goat here and don't fall for it. But what ended up happening is it looked like he wasn't willing to sort of stand up for himself in certain points. And I think as Hillary Clinton showed in the Benghazi hearings last week, you don't have to mix it up on every question, but mm-hmm. maybe if you do it once,
the cameras
it's memorable
will, yeah,
and,
pick that
and
one
leaves
up.
An impression. It
right.
shows, I really, you know, believe in what I'm saying. I believe in myself.
Yep.
I'm self-confident,
yep.
and that can help.
Nancy, count noses for us. Key swing votes here, if you can see them. I mean, who's on the bubble here? Who's on the fence?
Well, the first thing that has to happen is that it has to be voted out of the Armed Services Committee. And if mm-hmm. all the Democrats on the committee vote yes, then he'll make his way out of the Armed Services Committee to the Senate floor. Right now, all the Democrats on the committee appear that they will vote yes. And there's a good chance that a couple of Republicans may vote yes as well. We'll see. Some of the members of that committee, like Senator Ted Cruz, the new senator from Texas, you heard him really going after him. He says he's not going to vote for him. A couple of others. It'll be very interesting to see what John McCain and Lindsey Graham do. But once it gets to the Senate floor, as I said, you know, if all the Democrats vote for him, he just needs five Republicans to vote for him as well. And there's a good
Senate.
Chance that there are five there who, you know, remember him from the good old days and yep. will stand by him.
Nancy
again.
Cordes, please stand by in Washington. Indira Lakshmanan, Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Immigration, guns, Hegel in the hot seat, China hacks the New York Times, Israel hits Syria. Indira Lakshmanan is with us. Senior correspondent with Bloomberg News. Foreign policy is her beat. Nancy Cordes is here. Congressional correspondent for CBS News. Our own Jack Beatty. And plenty of callers coming in. Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores is calling. Dolores, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. What do you think?
Hey, great program. You're the best via TV and the radio.
All right.
First of all, I'd like to say that I spent 20 years in the Army, okay?
Okay.
And I was appalled at the behavior displayed by the Republican senators yesterday. I am more concerned about a Secretary of Defense who is going to look out for the welfare of the men and women in uniform. And he's going to fight to ensure that we do not get involved in conflicts in which we have no business being in. I mean, look what we cut out of Iraq. 4,400 dead men and women, over 32,000 seriously wounded, and hundreds of thousands more that will be scarred for life, mentally and emotionally. You know, and I... regarding the Jewish lobbying groups, I mean, what about AIPAC? We have people like Sheldon Adelson trying to influence senators. I'm just disgusted, and I hope that he gets the votes enough to where he will become our Secretary of Defense.
Dolores, we've got it. Lots of lobbyists in Washington, all stripes, but we've got it. Let's get one more from Hegel Country, Omaha, Nebraska. Dennis is calling. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that it seems like all the little kid Republicans are picking on the last responsible adult in their party. And if Chuck Hagel had been Secretary of Defense during the Bush years instead of Donald Rumsfeld, we'd have a President McCain now. That's all.
That's an interesting one to think about. John McCain was on his high horse yesterday. I don't know when they're going to drink beers next time. But, Dennis, we got it. And one more right here, Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I'm just so pleased with the personality and the viewpoints of Hegel, and I think he had a terrible time yesterday. John McCain was really cruel and vicious to him, but what's wonderful about him is that Hegel seems to have an idea of being more peaceable with everybody in the world, and that would include Iran. A lot of people are pushing Iran as if we have to have a war there because we've already had our 8 wars. We need a new one. We do not need a new war. And I just wish that he would say what he may realize, and few people do remember, that during Eisenhower's reign, Eisenhower had no war because he hated wars, but he did send our military over right into Iran when they had just elected democratically elected a man named Mossadegh, and we didn't like that because we wanted to have someone friendlier to us. So we actually, the military took out that elected leader.
Assassinated, no question about that. Jackie, we hear your support right there. Indira, I want to come to you on the issue of Iran and Hegel's posture. You know, the question kind of on the table here is what happens if Iran moves forward with its nuclear program, crosses a U.S. red line or a red line, and whether he would in fact be willing to go to war. The president has suggested that that option is on the table. All options are on the table. Hegel said that again yesterday. How do you see this tension playing out with the Secretary of Defense, Hegel, Indira?
Yeah, I think that the president chose Chuck Hagel because they're on the same side on this, which is to say that they both prioritize diplomacy and think that there can be and should be a way to resolve the dispute over Iran's nuclear program through international talks. And the president, again, we were sitting down with Hillary Clinton yesterday, and she said the president has not given up on talks. Again, she repeated that, you know, but the window for diplomacy is not going to stay open forever. I think at this point, you heard a somewhat different Chuck Hagel. He was making the point yesterday that, yes, I do support the crippling sanctions that the administration has on Iran. I do support talks, but military options are on the table. I mean, I asked Secretary Clinton straight up, why don't you go ahead and set an explicit red line or an explicit deadline for Iran? Because right now, the Iranians can't even agree on a time or a venue for where to meet for the next round of international talks on the nuclear program. And she said, well, constructive ambiguity, we have reasons for doing this, that, you know, we don't need to be so specific, but the Iranians have their own things going on, which is to say elections coming up in June. And every country, no matter how we see it, they do have politics, even if they're not the same kind of politics we have. So I think there's a fight going on within the Iranian elite, within the leadership, of how and whether to proceed with talks. Meanwhile, the nuclear program continues. So I think there are going to be some pretty tough choices to make. I don't necessarily agree with those who say that 2013 will have to be the decision year. If we trust U.S. intelligence, then U.S. intelligence has said that they have the ability to detect if and when Iran is able to have that breakout capacity to secretly go for a nuclear weapons capability. At this point, they're not there. So, I mean, I think it's a serious issue, and it's one they're going to have to prioritize. But I think looking at Chuck Hagel, he's in line mentally with where the president is, which is, like your caller said, try to avoid another war and try to settle it through talk. So I think we're gonna have to see where that one goes.
Nancy, there has been a sense in recent years of a kind of inexorable slide toward conflict here. If it's Chuck Hagel at the Pentagon, does that make a difference?
I think it does. You know, he spoke yesterday about the fact that he shares the president's view that if you can avoid conflict, you should. And that's obviously the reason that the president chose him. And so I think that going forward, whether it's Iran or whether it's engaging with terrorists in Mali or anywhere else, I think that they're going to be very careful about where they engage and about the parameters for when they engage and how they engage. And, you know, having very, very defined goals if they do get involved in a conflict, exactly what are we trying to achieve and how quickly can we get out?
Edward in Aiken, South Carolina. Edward, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi. What do you think?
I just wanted to say that I felt that Hagel was a poor selection for Secretary of Defense, given a number of factors, not least of which that he's opposed sanctions. He doesn't have administrative experience in a large organization like DOD, but perhaps most concerning is his inconsistency regarding his support of the Iraq War and his opposition to the surge. It seems to me no matter which position one had on the Iraq War, you can't support initiation and then fail to support a successful mission.
Edward, we've got it loud and clear. I mean, Jack, he was there, and then he was against it. And I wanted to ask you also, Jack, about the criticism he took yesterday for looking for a world without nuclear weapons. And he took some heat on that front as well. What do you say to that, Jack?
Yes, he was a member of an organization, Zero Option, I think, or something like that, which put out a...
Global Zero.
Global Zero, I beg your pardon, which put out a statement sort of saying, you know, the world would be better off without these weapons and we should get there. And he immediately stipulated, we never said that this should be done unilaterally. I am taking a position that Ronald Reagan took, and he quoted Ronald Reagan, Henry Kissinger has taken, George Shultz and others, who basically said the world would be better off without these weapons. It would be a great thing if they could be eliminated. It has to be done carefully. It has to be done bilaterally. It has to be done with verification. Trust but verify, President Reagan said. And I think Senator Hagel was well within the mainstream there of saying, that's what I signed on to. Some of the Republicans didn't like that.
As you say, this is a goal for a long time, but everything shifts. And yesterday it was presented as though that wasn't kind of a mainstream goal. Well, it sure was for a long time. We'll see where that goes. Chuck Hagel with a rough ride yesterday. Really interesting movement and conversation this week on a couple of other fronts, guns and immigration. I want to go to guns. There was Gabby Giffords. Who, of course, shot in the head in her district in Tucson and managed to recover and come back from that to testify before the Congress. Nancy Cordes, everybody was watching this. Is it moving the needle? Where do you see after Newtown and all those deaths and this gripping testimony from a congresswoman shot in the head and now back, is it clear that Congress is going to do something substantial with guns in this country?
Well, I was there in the hearing room when she gave that testimony, and I can tell you, you know, for everyone, no matter what side they were on, it was really unbelievable, really took your breath away to see, you know, how much she still struggles to walk and to talk. Her husband said she's partially blind and that she has lost her gift for speech, even though she, you know, she had what she wanted to say written out, and she delivered it flawlessly and with a lot of emphasis.
Movingly,
you could tell she really, really believed in what she was saying. And I think that there is, you know, in the past, there was an unwillingness even to talk about guns. You couldn't talk about it. It was it was just off the table. And so now the fact that both sides are willing to talk about it and are willing to acknowledge that there are some areas of bipartisan agreement is definitely a sign that there is the possibility for movement on this issue. And at that hearing, the consensus that emerged was that just about every Democrat and a lot of Republicans believe particularly that we should do something about background checks and that there are major loopholes right now. People who go to gun shows don't have to go through a background check, and that is something that could be expanded. There is also some bipartisan agreement when it comes to high-capacity magazines and perhaps limiting those, a lot less bipartisan agreement, but a little bit. When it comes to the assault weapons ban, that is something that both sides still agree really faces a very tough road. I haven't heard from one Republican who said, okay, well, maybe it's time to take a look at that. And there are a lot of Democrats who have doubts as well. But Democrats are moving very quickly. They're going to introduce, they already have introduced some legislation. They're going to be introducing more in the coming month. They want to strike while the iron is hot. And we'll see when they introduce legislation how much cooperation there is. But right now, everyone seems to be sort of like lowering the temperature on this issue and willing to work together.
Though, I mean, plenty of emotion with Gabby there. And the NRA still pushing back hard in these hearings. Wayne LaPierre, the executive VP there, even on background checks. I mean, he seemed kind of incredulous that the whole what should we do with guns issue was in front of Congress. But even on background checks, executive VP of the NRA saying, no thanks.
My problem with background checks is you're never going to get criminals to go through universal background checks. I mean, all the law-abiding people, you'll create an enormous federal bureaucracy.
You're never going to get everybody to go along with this. And, again, the suggestion that guns make people safer. Gabby Giffords' husband, Mark Kelly, spoke to that. Wayne LaPierre has talked about having a good guy with a gun is the only answer to a bad guy with a gun in schools. Mark Kelly said that when Gabby Giffords was shot, a quote-unquote good guy with a gun came within half a second of killing the wrong person when he thought about intervening in his wife's shooting.
With the first shot, a man ran out of Walgreens, a good guy with a gun. with the intent to do the right thing, an armed citizen. He came within, he admits that he came within about a half a second of shooting the man who tackled Jared Loughner and nearly killing him. I mean, we almost had this horrific mass murder followed up with a horrific accident.
Jack Beatty, we've got this interesting scene here where you've got legislation coming. You may have moves on background checks. I don't know about assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. You got the whole country on edge about this. But I wonder if this catalytic moment goes toward some damping down of guns or ultimately, out of all this emotion, toward the sort of Wayne LaPierre vision of more people arming up. Gun sales have been huge.
Well, and we heard some of that from Gail Trotter, who was one of the people who testified. She's a member of a conservative women's group, and she said she wanted women to arm up. She said an assault weapon in the hands of a young woman defending her babies in her home becomes a defense weapon. She wanted to have that assault weapon at home so that a mother could defend her babies. There is a nightmare vision, if you ever heard one. But, you know, also
the mother standing astride her babies with
yes.
With an assault, with semi-automatic rifle, yeah.
That's right, with the clips. But, you know, to me, the real-world nightmare was mentioned by Mark Kelly when he pointed out that the bullet in Tucson that killed Christina Taylor Green, the 9-year-old girl, mm-hmm. that was the 13th bullet in the clip. And Dianne Feinstein's bill would limit all clips to 10 bullets. It's very hard to see a rational argument that somebody's liberty interest, and rights under the Second Amendment would be violated at 10 bullets in a clip. And of course, if that had been the case, then in all probability, that 9-year-old girl would still be alive, because it was when he ran out of bullets, the 31 bullet, he was tackled.
We heard that theme from David Wheeler, parent to one of the children who died in Newtown, the Connecticut shooting, in a town hall meeting in Newtown last night.
The liberty of any person to own a military-style assault weapon and a high-capacity magazine and keep them in their home is second to the right of my son to his life.
A big point. That was Wednesday night out of Newtown, Connecticut. Marguerite's calling from Wakefield, Massachusetts. Marguerite, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's terrible that we suffer 31,000 deaths a year from guns. And no other country in the world allows such easy purchasing a weapon that can kill. And European countries require that a person who desires a gun must apply for it at a police station so they can check him.
Marguerite, but we're not a European country. We've got a different constitution. And what Wayne LaPierre points out, and everybody else, we've got, 200 million or something guns out there now. So what do you do in that reality?
Well, we have to cut down the availability of guns and really make it impossible for many people to buy them so easily. And the Second Amendment really disturbs me, Tom, because people like the late Judge Robert Bork has said the NRA thinks the Second Amendment refers to the right of anyone to have a gun. I don't agree with that, he said. I believe it refers to the militia, the right to have a militia.
Because the sitting Supreme Court has come in on that, and they've pretty much taken that NRA view. Indira, Marguerite raises the global picture here. We've just got 20 seconds before the break, but the way the rest of the world looks at us and our gun policy, gun population, Indira?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking about this because if you look at the world crime figures from the UNODC, the UN organization that looks at drugs and violence, I mean, you can see that the most gun violence is in Honduras, where you have something like 68 homicides per 100,000 people, even though they have a somewhat lower firearm rate than some other countries. So there are a lot of factors that go into it, but I don't think anyone would argue.
We're right up against a break here. Indira Lakshman, please stand by in Washington. Nancy Cordes, Jack Beatty. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, fire in a packed Brazil nightclub left an astonishing 234 people dead. Audrey Righi survived the fire. She spoke with NBC about the horror.
People crying, people dying in my sight. I lost very special people for me.
Former New York Mayor Ed Koch died today at 88, the high spirit. How am I doing, Mayor of the Big Apple? Here he is years later in 1997.
When I'm in a restaurant, people might say, well, you know, oh, there's Mayor Ed Koch. I say to myself, isn't that sweet that they're still interested in me? Honest, close to 8 years that I'm out of office and they still remember me. It's wonderful.
And NBC's 30 Rock signing off last night after seven seasons. Tina Fey, Alec Baldwin, here's their iconic theme, and Tracy Jordan, played by Tracy Morgan, wrapping it up.
Thank you, America. That's our show. Not a lot of people watched it, but the joke's on you, because we got paid anyway.
30 Rock laughs to the end. We're looking at a week in the news. Immigration, guns, Hegel in the hot seat. China hacks the New York Times. Indira Lakshminan is with us from Bloomberg News. Nancy Cordes from CBS News. Jack Beatty's here. A couple more on guns. Scott, Charlestown, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah.
The reason I'm calling is there's a response to the clip from the Newtown town meeting. And as horrible a tragedy as this is, you know, the father's quote about saying how our liberties are second to the life of his son. And again, as much a tragedy as this is, these are our rights and our liberties. And we're talking about our Constitution that our forefathers created for us to protect us from tyrannical governments that they were fleeing from. And by eliminating these rights or putting bans and restrictions on these rights, we're sacrificing our Americanism.
But which way? What's more important? That father's saying the right of my child to live, to have lived, is more important than the liberty, he said, to bear arms. How do you sort that out, Scott?
Tom, it's a horrible tragedy that happens, but life and death, that happens every day. And we live in an incredibly brutal world. And unfortunately, everywhere around the world, children are dying every day.
Hey, you know, but we have more gun deaths here than in an awful lot of places. I mean, I take your point, though, Scott. But Nancy, here we go again. The country's sort of trying to decide in the face of the reality of all these guns out there already. You know, maybe the answer to that father's plea almost to shift the balance of what matters here. I mean, after all, right to life is right, comes first before right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life comes first, he's saying.
Right. And these are such difficult issues to grapple with. You know, in that hearing this week where most people seem to sincerely want to do something, there was also a lot of discussion about mental health and what could be done on that front to keep people with mental health issues from getting guns, to help them get the help that they need. And it was such a difficult issue for people really danced around it, but no one seemed to have the answer. And there certainly wasn't anyone who was an expert on it on the panel. To talk about, you know, some were saying, well, maybe we should go back to the days when we committed more people. We've gotten away from that. And then others said, you know, we've got to really respect the rights of people who are mentally ill. We can't go too far. And then others said we can't stigmatize people who are mentally ill and act as if they're violent, because the vast majority of them, 99%, are not. So I think, you know, just on this one topic alone, mm-hmm. you can see how even if there are all kinds of people who want to do the right thing, their view of what that right thing is very different, and sometimes they don't know at all.
Laura in Oxford, Connecticut. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that we've got this knee-jerk reaction about things like this that happen, and no one is asking anything about this kid. This kid committed this crime, and I really believe that his father, his brother, his former teachers knew that this child was a danger. And possibly that's why his parents were divorced. Possibly that's why he was being homeschooled.
So you're saying look at mental health, but there he has this cache of weapons to dip into, Laura. What about it?
The thing is that if somebody is crazy, they can kill you with a hubcap. Mm. The thing is, we have to start looking at these kids. You know, these children, when I had my son, I was in the hospital, and they were giving us a baby class of how to bathe your baby.
Yeah.
And they picked this child. And the nurse said, and we have this beautiful baby boy, and what is his name? And the mother said, it ain't got no goddamn name yet. Now, there's a lot of this going on, and no one ever addresses how these children...
Laura, we've got it. There's a rough start you depict right there, and I get it. On the other hand, you can kill somebody with a hubcap, yes, but it's a whole lot rougher. I mean,
Jackie, and you can't kill 20 people at once with a hubcap.
Yes, and not in 3.5 minutes. I mean, Jack, there's a picture being put out here on the one hand. We need to try and contain this, do something. I mean, the poor girl from Chicago, she marches at the Inauguration Day parade, and the next thing you know, she's killed in a bus stop in Chicago, and many more. Now, there's gun control there, but all around it, there's not. I mean, what kind of, are we really going to arm up and become the Wild West? Is that the way we have to go in the face of all the guns out there now, Jack?
Well, there's so much fear, and the hearings touched on that. Scenarios were given of almost from sort of doomsday movies, that there'll be a natural disaster, Sandy or the Los Angeles riots. What are you going to do when the police can't come? And Mr. LaPierre said, you'll need a gun to defend yourself. And that kind of thinking is never, never dim in this country. But you know
what? We had decades of Hollywood movies devoted to saying, look, the West was once that way. And it was nuts, and there was a romance, but it was deadly, and we got on top. We changed. This was the Hollywood message anyway. We grew up as a country. We got away from solving our disputes with pistols on our hips.
We did, and in fact, that itself was a falsehood because, as subsequent research has pointed out, most of these cow towns had extreme gun laws. They didn't allow people to take guns into the city limits because they weren't so stupid as to allow people to take guns into saloons, which you can do now in many, many states. But, you know, this question about guns versus mental illness, I mean, I don't know what Laura would say to this, but mental illness is the same pretty much all around the world, right? People have emotional problems.
Yeah.
But the rest of the world doesn't have it, maybe Honduras excepted, doesn't have anything like our gun violence or our suicide violence. I mean, if mental illness leads to suicide and about 15,000 people a year in America, something like that, kill themselves with guns, if they had the guns, they couldn't kill. If they didn't have the guns, they couldn't kill themselves with hubcaps. I mean,
it would be tougher. There are other ways, but it would be tougher. We're gonna continue to follow this issue, but we've got more to look at today. Immigration. Big on Capitol Hill right now, big push, bipartisan, 8 senators, 4 Republican, 4 Democrats, and then the president on Monday, there was Chuck Schumer, Senator Democrat from New York, laying out the framework, saying that tougher border security is in there and a path to citizenship for current illegal or undocumented immigrants in this country, plus a reformed employment verification program.
The key to our compromise is to recognize that Americans overwhelmingly oppose illegal immigration and support legal immigration. First, we create a tough but fair path to citizenship for illegal immigrants currently living in the United States that is contingent upon securing our borders.
Okay, here's another big one. Nancy Cordes, tough but fair was the message there. Do you see this moving toward action, or is this all like meta-level political positioning for the next election? Which party's most amenable or most opposed?
No, well, I think actually both sides have a lot of incentive to try to get this done. For the Democrats, it's the fact that the president really wants to have a legacy, and he knows that if he's able to pass large-scale immigration reform, that will really be a feather in his cap. For Republicans, it's obviously the fact that the president won 71% of the Latino vote in 2012, and that this is a group that they really need to start thinking more about. So the incentives are there on both sides, and the fact that that these 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats in the Senate, heavy hitters. I mean, these are not sort of rank and file members. These are leaders in their party who have come together around a set of principles, and they say they're going to be working very quickly to craft legislation. And meanwhile, the same thing is going on in the House. You've got a bipartisan group there that's been working to put out something very quickly. So it does seem that the will is there. The question is going to be, once they are able to craft this legislation, Republicans are going to need to see that the border security component is real. Their complaint has always been, and with legislation that Congress has tried to pass time and time again, you are offering amnesty, essentially, to people who have come here illegally, and you're not going to do enough about the borders. So they are going to want hard and fast proof that border security is really going to be addressed legal status.
But I don't know what real means precisely. I mean, does it mean the wall all the way along? And we've had year after year of new technology put out there, more people put out there. The numbers have come way down for all kinds of reasons. But what is real? What does it mean? The numbers are down. Is that real then, or something else?
Well, that's a good question, and we've asked the members of this Gang of Eight several times. Well, okay, what does that mean? You know, what is real border security? And they say they're still working that out. They're still trying to figure out, you know, okay, when are we going to be able to say we have secured the border enough that we can now give the 11 million illegal immigrants in this country temporary legal status so they can start working towards their citizenship if they pass a background check and pay a fine and all these things. So that's something that they are still trying to define as well. And, you know, they hope that within the next month or two, they can come up with a definition that is understandable to everyone and, you know, that the legislation can move forward.
Jack, what do you see coming together on the immigration front?
Well, I think Nancy states it well. Each side has a very strong incentive, and the president is defensive, and perhaps rightly, on this issue of border security. He told Univision this week, he said, we've done more on border security in the last 4 years than was done in the previous 20. We've actually done almost everything the Republicans asked to be done as a precondition to move forward on comprehensive immigration reform. In other words, he seems to be saying, we've already done border security, so let's not talk about this as a precondition. Yes, we'll do it parallel, but let's not have this until in there. You know, we will have, we have to wait until we have border security. He's saying we have it, and the data which show a sharp decrease in illegal immigration seem to bear him out, although the cause of that may be less border security than our parlous economy.
It's going to be fascinating to follow this as it gets really pinned down and definitions here and whether it becomes the sense of amnesty or it's what we've got to do to move forward. And, dear, I want to come to you on several big stories abroad. You know, Egypt this week, we're hearing from top military folks there, and they've got their own interests. But, you know, the state may be on the verge of collapsing. Here's the sound of protesters in Cairo chanting, "We support Port Said," after all the action in the streets there. And activist Hisham Kassem speaking with the BBC about whether the continuing protests in Egypt are worth it for the people who have suffered so much.
It's definitely worth it. Okay, we're going through hard times, but to live in a free country, it's worth all this chaos. Egyptians cannot be pushed around anymore.
Indira, what do you see happening in Egypt? Is it falling apart? Is that just the military trying to find a way back into more influence? What's going on?
I think it's fascinating that you see the declaration of martial law by the, you know, freely elected President Mohamed Morsi for the first time since, remember him, Hosni Mubarak.
30 years.
military leader.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting. Let's watch what happens today. By the end of the day, thousands of opponents of Morsi are now in the streets today on the traditional prayer day on Friday, and they're demanding his overthrow. There's been some of the deadliest violence in the 7 months since he took power. Remember, just a week ago, there were demonstrations that marked the second anniversary of the uprising that ousted Mubarak. Almost 60 people, that's right, Tahrir Square, and almost 60 people were killed in that violence. Port Said is a whole separate thing with the soccer riots that happened a year ago and more
separate,
riots.
But not because those soccer clubs were at the heart of a lot of what went on in Tahrir Square. I mean, this looked almost like payback here.
Yes, you're right. And you know, military law or emergency powers were declared there and elsewhere. So we see all over the country a lot of problems. One thing I found fascinating, my Bloomberg colleagues in Egypt have reported on this, is the rise of some of these Mubarak sympathizers, youth with wearing black masks in the street who are dubbing themselves the Black Bloc.
Why?
And they say that their mission is to protect supposedly the protesters from the Muslim Brotherhood. And then you have rival groups springing up. Like an Islamist group calling itself the White Bloc, who are trying to stop their rivals, who are trying to topple the government. And you have another group of masked armed men calling themselves Muslim militias, who say that they're independent from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Mohamed Morsi's party, but they're opposed to the democratic, liberal, so-called progressive protesters. So there are a lot of problems going on here, and
that,
I don't
that
know.
That is a welter. We're going to look more at that one on Monday, Indira. Take us for a second to the Syrian front. You've got Joe Biden, he's in Europe right now, sitting down in Munich with the top opposition leader, Moaz al-Khatib, out of Syria. Does this signal, who's also meeting with Russians, does this signal potentially a new level of U.S. involvement there, Indira?
Look, the United Nations has already said that more than 60,000 people have been killed in Syria in less than 2 years now. But this is dragged on for a long time. At the same time, we know that the Obama administration is not ready to arm the opposition. And again, Hillary Clinton confirmed that last night in her last interview as Secretary of State. They are warning against unintended consequences and telling Gulf states and Turkey and, you know, some of the U.S. allies who are arming the opposition, you know, Hillary Clinton made a very interesting analogy. She said, remember in the 1980s when we all got together trying to oust the Soviet Union from Afghanistan? Well, we succeeded, but look what it brought us. Look what happened in Afghanistan in the 1990s. So it's watch what you ask for, because you just might get something else that you're not expecting.
And yet it seems to be sort of coming apart anyway. Our time is so short. We've got that Israeli airstrike, very interesting, reportedly to go after anti-aircraft missiles there that may have been headed to Hezbollah. See how that plays out. At home, unemployment ticking up, Nancy Curtis, just 7.8, 7.9, but that's not the direction anybody wants to see, though. At the same time, looking here this morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average over 14,000 this morning for the first time since October 2007.
That's right. And the White House is saying, you know, this is a sign that the economy is improving slowly. It added 157,000 jobs in January. It was predicted that it was going to create several thousand more. But we often see that these numbers get estimated at one level, and then the following month they get moved up to another level. So the White House says it's important to look at the big picture here. Republicans say that the economy should be growing much faster at this point, so long from the start of the recession.
Jack, there's the story that grinds along beneath everything else. And in these numbers, well, it's not happy days are here again.
Not yet. And the sequester, as we saw in December, it was a cutback in government spending that dipped the economy into negative growth.
Mm-hmm.
That could be right ahead. Next month.
Could be right in front of us. Nancy Curtis with CBS News, covering Congress in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us today, Nancy.
You're so welcome.
Indira Lakshman on with Bloomberg News. Thank you, Indira.
Really happy to be here.
And Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. There's a week. This is On Point.